Welcome to The Point. I'm Sean Corcoran, news director at WCAI, and this is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top stories of the week with my colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me here in our Woods Hole studio is Sean Driscoll, a reporter at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Good morning, Sean.
Good morning.
And joining us a little later will be Tim Wood, the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Josh Balling is calling in from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. We'll hear from Sally Rose of the Provincetown Banner, Jeff Spillane of the Mashpee Enterprise, Jim Deruta of the New Bedford Standard Times, and Nelson Siegelman, editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. It's a big morning, Sean.
Well, I can go have a cup of coffee. It sounds like you've got plenty to do.
We've got lots of news, and I'm hoping that you're going to be part of the discussion as well. Let's start with a story, the big story of the day, the story we've been watching for weeks. Market Basket has a deal has been reached, Sean.
Yes, absolutely. As we all know, the two Arthurs have been battling out over control over the, as it turns out, beloved Massachusetts-based supermarket chain, and Artie T. I always have to think of the T and the S, but they reached a deal for him to buy the 51% stake that was owned by his rival cousin for $1.5 billion. So that's exactly what employees wanted. It's what a lot of customers wanted, and the stores are getting ready to get back into business now.
Right. We've had weeks of analysis of this story all over the airwaves, of course. And in our area, we have a Market Basket in Sagamore on the Cape side of the bridge, and also in New Bedford. Was there some reaction at those stores after the news came down yesterday?
Yes. As early as yesterday, the shelves were starting to get repopulated, especially the bakery and the things that they can make in the store. And customers were coming back, and they were all very excited that they had their stores back. Our business reporter Amy Anthony was out there, and in a story in today's paper, the employees were thrilled, the customers were thrilled. Just in time for the Labor Day weekend, they can get back in and start doing their shopping again.
And it was such an event when Market Basket opened here on Cape Cod, particularly for a place like Bourne, where they don't have a supermarket.
Yes, absolutely. And that location there at the bridge, I mean, so many people stop coming on Cape or stop going off Cape. It's a popular place.
Oh, it sure is a popular place. I mean, going up to the deli counter, it's kind of like the stock
exchange.
It's
hockey. Yeah, I don't know what it is. You got to have a sharp elbow to get your lunch meat up there.
You're right. Okay, let's move on to another story. This story in today's paper, and it's something that's been floating around the Twitterverse. That app. That social media application, Twitter. There's been a screen grab from a posting by the town clerk in Sandwich, which is seemingly anti-Muslim, and George Brennan was able to track that down and get some confirmation from the town clerk in Sandwich that, yes, he actually did post these comments. Tell us about this.
Yeah, well, town clerk Taylor White admitted that he did make a post on Facebook, I believe, that was captured and then passed around on Twitter saying, reacting to a story about a Vermont restaurant that's not advertising bacon specials anymore because members of the Muslim religion find that product to be offensive to their religion. And he found that frustrating, apparently, and made a comment to the effect of, let's make September irritate a Muslim month. I'm paraphrasing at this point, but said that the do everything in your power to irritate the, quote, religion of peace, is what he wrote, and these people need to be taught a lesson. And that has not gone over well with a lot of people, those comments. He said he made them in jest. The town Republicans are saying he still has a freedom of speech, even though he's an elected official, but the Democrats in the area and a lot of other people are not pleased with a remark that he says was a joke.
Mm. And he is elected official.
Yes.
So that's an elected position there. And what's his salary?
He earned $72,000, according to Georgia's story.
And there was another comment in there as well, something about throwing bacon or something like that, which seems to be a reference to this news story. You can't see the news story in the screen grab, so
right.
It's hard to know what he's reacting to. So it's
right.
Hard to have context for these seemingly anti-Muslim comments.
Absolutely. But he does admit that he made the comments. He made them in jest, he says, and now that he's embarrassed, and he says that he does apologize for it.
He also indicated that he might have been drinking at the time he made those comments.
He did indicate that, yes, which, you know, booze and Facebook never mix, especially when you're an elected official.
But I would say, yes.
He did, if that is indeed the case, he did indicate that might have been a factor.
And I understand you just got a note from your colleague, George Brennan, who has this story in the paper. What's he saying?
Well, he sent me an email just moments ago saying he was seeing some chatter on Twitter, again, the social media, that some people were at Sandwich Town Hall protesting the situation. So we don't have confirmation of that, but if, you know, there is some talk about it on social media. So people, obviously, despite the apology, are upset about the situation.
Okay, and if people want to see that screen grab, I do have it on my Twitter, at Corcoran, WCAI. Let's move on to a different elected official, or former elected official,
yes.
Representative Bill Delahunt, who is getting into the medicinal marijuana business.
Trying to
get in. And he's another one of those, him and his group is suing the state now. And we've seen some of these lawsuits by some of these ventures that were not successful in getting a license to open. So what's happening with former Congressman Delahunt?
Well, Rep. Delahunt's group had received some provisional licenses from the state to open medical marijuana dispensaries, including one in Mashpee. But when the state issued their final licensure, Delahunt's group did not get any of those approved. So now they're suing the state, saying that they violated basically their own rules in withdrawing the license, and they want the right to open those dispensaries.
Three dispensaries, Mashpee being one of them. Another would be in Plymouth, and another one in Taunton. And when they did receive the initial approval to move into the next round of the process, it seemed like Representative Delahunt's group was pretty highly ranked. Do we have any indication about what has changed, why they did not receive this license?
Yeah, well, according to this story by Christine Legere, after some more scrutiny of the applications, there were some concerns regarding profit projections for the investors and the claims of support for the organization's applications. And then in June, when the Department of Public Health did whittle that list down to 11 from 20, all three of Delahunt's operations got nixed. And I believe that those were some of the concerns that they had highlighted.
And I think also in that story, it mentions that Delahunt's group is also asking a judge not to let the state move forward with other dispensaries in those locations in order to give them a chance.
Right,
to have
want the rights for those places.
Okay. Well, the marijuana story is not going away. Certainly medicinal marijuana, those dispensaries could be opening up here in the state by the end of the year, or if not early next year. That's the most recent reporting on that. And there also are indications that there could be recreational marijuana initiatives in perhaps 2016, I think I've read.
Right.
Let's talk about a story, ticks. We've talked a lot about ticks here on WCAI. We should be talking about ticks because it is a scourge here on the Cape, the islands, and the South Coast. The amount of ticks and the amount of disease associated with those ticks, people have to be vigilant. Now we're hearing reporter Cindy McCormick is telling us about a new disease that we should be aware of that is being passed by typically deer ticks, is my understanding.
Yes. Cindy wrote this week about newly emerging illnesses, anaplasmosis and babesiosis.
Babesiosis, yes. Those have been around a bit, but they're increasing in number. It's this,
right?
What is it? Myatoa.
Yeah, we don't have to worry about pronunciation in the print media, but
okay.
Yes, it's been detected now in more than a dozen Cape Codders. So, diagnosed 13 to 14 people from the Cape with that tick-borne illness this summer. Not huge numbers. Lyme is still the prevalent disease that's caused by ticks, but there is concern that is. Excuse the pun here on the uptick here on the Cape, that there is something new emerging.
Yes, and certainly if there are any unexplained fevers or headaches or fatigue or joint pain, people should be going to their doctor and not just thinking it might be something
the flu
that's
or something like that. Right, especially if you've been outside, if you're not wearing your long pants and staying covered up like we're all supposed to, which we all should be doing, but of course, sometimes you run into the woods and you have shorts, or your kid runs into the woods and you got to go after him. I mean, it's hard to. Vigilance is not always 100%, so you do have to keep an eye on yourself and for those symptoms.
And there was a story earlier in the week also about ticks, I believe, saying that their numbers are pretty high right now on the Cape. Typically what happens in July is things dry up fairly significantly around here. The dry weather is not good for ticks, but it hasn't been that dry comparatively.
Yeah, kind of cool and damp in July, so they really didn't have a chance for the heat to do its job. So the populations of ticks are up, so we're likely to see more of these cases this year just because the ticks are in greater numbers.
Right, and going into the fall, you have the adult ticks out in great numbers, and those ticks have already eaten twice, so they've twice had the chance to get disease that they can pass on to you or a person Okay, so we got the tick issue covered, hopefully, and that one's not going away. It's a major problem here on the Cape, the Islands, and the coast. Let's talk about a story that you've been covering this week. Really interesting story. It was in the Sunday paper, and I'm sure there'll be follow-up to it about you describe it. It's a neighborhood or association
Seacoast Shores.
It's in Falmouth.
It's in Falmouth. It's in East Falmouth on Seacoast Shores Boulevard, just past the Wacoit Reserve as you're coming into town from Mashpee. And it's both a neighborhood and a neighborhood association. And the issue out there is that there's about 900 homes, and they have very nice waterfront property because they're surrounded on – it's a peninsula. But the association, which is basically a homeowners association, is saying that they don't have enough money in their treasury to maintain all the rights of way to the water, and there's a small beach there that the entire neighborhood can use. And part of the problem, they're saying, is that of those 900 homes, only about 300 of them pay the dues to be in this homeowners association. It's not mandatory.
Voluntary dues.
And historically, only about 300 to 400 of them have paid. And over the years, that hasn't left enough money to put any in reserve for basically capital improvements to their assets, is what the association leadership is saying. But a lot of residents out there say the real problem is that a couple years ago, they built a $1.2 million clubhouse that not even all the association members can access. You have to pay more money to get full access to that. And there's a lot of residents out there say that's really the problem, that this clubhouse is soaking up the money that could otherwise go toward, you know, the right of ways and the beach and that, and they don't want to pay to support something that necessarily they can't always use.
So some residents see this as a boondoggle that's drawing money away from the real needs, which would be maintaining those right of ways so people can get to that beach that they enjoy using. So I understand from the reporting that one of the possibilities on the table is selling some of those right of ways.
That is a possibility, but it's not one that the association really wants to do. They told me that they had sort of a save or sell campaign going into a meeting two meetings actually that were held last Saturday, and they're having a third one this weekend, trying to get people's attention and wake them up to the reality that if we can't maintain these things, they're going to be gone. It's turned into a little bit of a class issue because residents see this clubhouse, and then now these leaders are saying you have to sell the properties, and you know, there is just a lot of tension out there and a lot of distrust about the finances and what the money is going toward and why this is a problem all of a sudden.
It's a good story. It was in the Sunday paper in the Cape Cod Times this week. And
a follow-up in today's paper,
It's well-researched. A lot of documents I can tell you went through there. So I encourage people to look at that reporting. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, Tim Wood is going to join us. He's the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on WCAI. We're talking about the top stories of the week. I'm Sean Corcoran, and with me in our Woods Hole studio is Sean Driscoll, a reporter at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Joining us on the phone is News Roundup regular Tim Wood, the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle from his newsroom out there in Chatham. Hello, Tim.
Good morning, Sean.
Good morning. Let's talk about sharks. And there's the possibility that you have a story in the paper this week about the possibility that sharks could be heading into Nantucket Sound, where we haven't seen too many great white sharks.
Indeed. You know, we've had a lot of shark sightings this summer, especially in the last few weeks. And there have been a number of them tagged by Greg Scommel, who we just heard there. But the sighting that caught everyone's attention came last week when a 12 to 14-foot great white shark was seen west of South Beach down here in Chatham. Now, usually the sharks are sighted in the area called Shark Cove, which is in the area east of South Beach on the Atlantic. But this was the first confirmed sighting of a white shark on the other side of the Barrier Beach. And apparently this shark had swam through the inlet down there on South Beach. Boaters videotaped it. John Chisholm, who works with Greg Scommel, was able to hop on board a Harbor Patrol boat and get some underwater footage of this particular animal. And the great white, the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy, which is funding Greg Scommel's work this summer, also got some pretty dramatic aerial footage of this shark sort of milling about the coves there near the inlet. And it came within a few yards of the inner beach, and you can kind of see a couple people standing on the shore right there, and you can't see their faces, but they seemed like they were a little anxious. The animal apparently swam around the inlet, I couldn't get out right away because this tide had dropped, and the Harbor Patrol was able to follow it for quite a while. The town issued a warning reiterating that swimming is prohibited on that off of South Beach and in that area. But the real concern is whether this is sort of a harbinger of the sharks moving further west towards Nantucket Sound. Now, we've seen seals in Nantucket Sound for quite a while, you know, the sharks follow the seals, so there's every possibility that that could be the case. I corresponded with Greg Skomel about this. He said he had no idea what the shark was doing there, whether it was chasing a seal or just exploring or got lost or something. But the Harbor Patrol Department put out really their last buoy that they had that's equipped with an acoustic receiver to register the sharks that have been tagged. They put this out in that area just as a precaution to monitor to see if any of the tagged sharks are heading that way. The one that was in that area last week wasn't tagged, and so the sharks that aren't tagged obviously aren't going to register there, but it's certain that they're going to be keeping a close eye on that area over the next few weeks.
Well, sharks are now part of the scene, that's for sure, here on the Cape and the Islands.
Indeed, yeah.
Let's talk about this Ms. Eelgrass contest. I mean, 20 years ago, folks may remember there was this Ms. Eelgrass contest. Maybe it was Miss at that time, I'm not sure. tell us about...
It changed a little bit, yeah.
Tell us about this.
Yeah, let me give you some background on this. About 30 years ago, fishermen noticed that Paul Lucas's boat had grown quite a good crop of eelgrass on its hull, and they began calling Paul Captain Eelgrass. The nickname stuck. And when there were some local residents were looking at how to raise some funds for some local kids organizations, they hit on the idea of let's find a mate for Captain Eelgrass. So that's the Ms. Eelgrass contest was born, and it became a real local evening of fun and merriment for the people around here. You had contestants decked out in shells and seaweed and mermaid tails with names like Scallop O'Hara, vying for the title of Miss Eelgrass. they had a 10-year run of that, and they raised thousands of dollars for kids groups in town before they decided to call it quits. Now, to mark the 30th anniversary of that first one, the Chatham Merchants Association has resurrected the event, and the captain himself will return this Saturday at 6 p.m. at the Chatham VFW to choose a new mate from among about a dozen contestants that have been lined up for this. It's going to be a great evening. There's going to be music and food, auction, a raffle, and certainly a lot of good-natured antics. A lot of people are looking forward to it as sort of a last hurrah of the summer for local residents. Tickets are $10, and they're available at the door.
Okay. Thank you very much. Tim Wood is the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. You can follow the Chronicle Newsroom on Twitter at CCC Newsroom. Thank you, Tim.
Thanks, Sean.
And let's also stay on the phones. Josh Balling is joining us. He's the assistant editor of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, as well as the director of digital content at the paper. Hello, Josh.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Let's talk about these warning sirens that are going to be installed across the island. What are they going to warn people about?
They're supposed to warn people of fires, impending storms, other natural disasters, or emergency events, and they're causing a little bit of a buzz right now. The town officials, the police chief, and the emergency preparedness coordinator in particular are touting them as standard operating procedure in a lot of communities. They say that a lot of places in the country have them for various purposes, and their intent, it's called an early warning system, is to let people know that they should tune into a local radio or TV station or go online and find out what's going on. They cost about $45,000, $50,000 to install. There's going to be three of them on the island, one on each end in Mattaquette and Sconset at the fire stations on the east and west ends, and then one in the middle of the island. And the idea is that if these sirens go off, if you hear them, you should turn on the radio, turn on the TV, go online, and find out what kind of information you need to know about whether it's a storm coming or if there's a major fire or road closures or other information like that. Interestingly, though, it's not being embraced by just about everybody. The One member of the Board of Selectmen has come out and said he doesn't quite understand why the town is doing this. There's other technology out there that is less intrusive, and almost this seems to be almost a step backward. Other people we've got on social media, on our Facebook page, coming out and saying they think the money could be more wisely spent elsewhere, that there are other forms of, again, technology and communication today that would probably make more sense. They're worried that perhaps people hear sirens, and we don't know exactly what they're going to sound like yet, but I think people are envisioning some kind of World War II-era air raid horn going off and panicking people, and people, especially visitors perhaps, who don't know about this this system, wondering what's going on, not necessarily knowing that they have to tune in to find out more information, and then perhaps panicking a little bit about that. The police chief and the emergency preparedness coordinator say shouldn't be the case. They believe that there'll be enough education prior that people will know what's going on, and they'll do exactly what they're supposed to, is find out what's going on, and so they won't necessarily panic. But it's interesting to see what happens when they get installed next spring. They're going to be testing them as well. The plan is to test them on a monthly basis, so it could be a little noisier on Nantucket than we're used to starting next year.
So the effort really isn't up for debate. It's going to happen. There was no, didn't require any vote by town meeting.
It did not require a vote by town meeting. The funding was included in a capital spending proposal that was approved at the past town meeting with zero debate. It did not raise any eyebrows at the time prior to town meeting. Nobody questioned it on the floor. It was proposed as simply a line item for a early warning system. And nobody said anything, and now it was raised at the last selectmen's meeting. People, debating a little bit back and forth. There are supporters as well. They feel that
sure.
This is a good idea. That any information we can get, any early warning. Nobody's saying that we're going to be subject to a tsunami or an earthquake or anything like that. But they say if you can let us, if we're outside, if we're not close to close to the internet, we're not on any of our devices. If we hear that warning, we'll know that there's something we better pay attention to.
Josh, just briefly here, we have a moment. Another topic, a big discussion topic on the island, of course, is the new Stop and Shop, and it now looks like that's going to go forward.
It certainly does. Stop and Shop has applied for building permits for the partial demolition of their existing supermarket between Sparks Avenue and Pleasant Street, and the construction of a new store on the property adjacent to the Nantucket Fire Department. This was approved back in the early summer, by the planning board, but it was appealed by neighbors, and Stop and Shop officials, it looks like now, are moving forward despite that appeal. It's supposed to be heard later this year in Boston Land Court. Planning Director Andrew Vore says they are proceeding at their own risk. This is certainly allowed. Sometimes developers, builders will move forward in spite of appeals and take their chances with what happens. Stop and Shop is looking to build about a 38,000 square foot store. Just about everybody acknowledges on Nantucket that the current Mid Island store is not nearly big enough for, especially the summer traffic that goes into it. There's not enough parking. Everybody acknowledges that they should have one, but a couple of neighbors have appealed, saying that they've got concerns about the traffic, about the impact on their quality of life. And Stop and Shop officials right now saying that, yes, we acknowledge we have applied for the building permits, but they haven't made a firm decision about whether they're going to move forward or not, but it certainly looks like they will. We've heard from some vendors that they've been told they need to clear out some of their in-store storage so that what they're calling the compression of the store can begin in the coming weeks. They're going to take about a third of the store and demolish that, put up a new wall, and use that for parking while the new store is being built. So they'll still be parking in the off season, and they hope to have a new store up and running by early next summer or late next spring.
Okay, Josh, thank you very much. Very comprehensive. Joshua Balling is the assistant editor of the Nantucket Inquirer at Mirror, as well as the director of digital content at the paper, and of course a regular here on the News Roundup. Josh, we appreciate it. Folks can follow you on Twitter at JBallingIM. Thanks, Josh.
Thank you.
Let's go to Sally Rose. She's the editor of the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Sally.
Good morning, John.
In Provincetown, there's this ad hoc charter review committee. So they're taking a look at the charter, and now they're creating a buffer between them and the selectmen. What's the issue there?
Well, right. So the ad hoc charter review committee, they were put together about a year ago in order to go through all of the charter and come up with recommendations for updated charter. So in any kind of revisions. So they came to the selectmen early this week and told them that its members are now stepping down from that job in the hopes of returning as an elected body. So this comes just as the committee's one-year charge is about to expire at the end of this month, and even though its job, its recommendations are still incomplete, just recently the selectmen had been facing the decision of whether to extend the charter review's charge or allow it to dissolve without the work completed. But the ad hoc committee beat them to it, voting to dissolve itself. And on Monday, the members announced their support for an elected commission that would then resume its work with greater independence and power. And as it previously stood, any charter recommendations made by the appointed committee would have been just that, recommendations, and they would then be subject to approval by the selectmen in order for them to move forward. The members of the charter review would then have no role subsequently in achieving any of those hoped-for changes. Versus in the elected model, which begins with the need for a petition with at least 15% of voters signing, which would be, I guess, about 430 signatures, the commission could then bring charter change proposals directly to town meeting for an up or down vote. Actually, the selectmen ultimately agreed to that.
So they don't want to do all this work only to have the selectmen then just bat it down haphazardly. They want to be able to take it directly to the people at town meeting. Wouldn't an ad hoc, doesn't it require a change in the charter to create a committee that actually is elected?
No, there are provisions for that, actually, at the state level. There are two different, I guess there are a couple different ways can affect charter changes to the charter. And both of these are in there, but there's different processes that must be followed, and the elected model is certainly one of them, and it was used, I think, previously in Provincetown, I think in the 1990s. So it should be interesting. It also means that there's going to be a delay, likely 2 years before any changes would occur.
Okay.
But I think so there are some individual changes that might be brought to a sooner town meeting by the selectmen.
Interesting. Okay, it's a little complicated, but important that the charter, it really rules the community and how things work. Sally Rose is the editor of the Provincetown Banner. We appreciate it. Thank you, Sally.
Thank you, Sean.
And on the phone now is Jeff Spillane. He's a reporter at the Mashpee Enterprise. Hello, Jeff.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning to you. Now, there's an area of Mashpee, a neighborhood in Mashpee. They say, look, there's too much drug activity around here, and they're concerned about that. What's going on?
Yeah, there is. It's the area that is on the south side of John's Pond, between the pond and Route 151. It's bordered by Algonquin Avenue and Ninegret Avenue. And since 2011, it has been the scene of quite a few crimes. There's been a shooting, several heroin busts. There's been firearms arrests, lots of street fighting there. And a group of residents have pretty much said, geez, you know, we've had enough. This is affecting our quality of life. And they invited me to come and meet with them earlier this week. And I did, and it was really stunning what I found, how these people are living there. They do not let their kids out during the day. They find bags of heroin on the street. There's a steady stream of traffic. One of the residents said it's like it's an all-night Dunkin' Donuts. And some of the older residents are becoming scared to live alone. It really is quite a bad situation there for these residents.
What are law enforcement officials telling you?
Yeah, well, I did speak with Rodney Collins, the chief of police. And by the way, the residents could not say enough about the Mashpee police. Or, if anything, they were a little bit upset about these people getting arrested and then being back on the street a few days later. So it was more about the court system than anything else. But Chief Collins said that he is keenly aware of what's going on there. He wouldn't comment on any investigations, but you can bet there are several going on, and that there are targeted patrols in that area.
That is a tough situation. I mean, what do you do
about
that?
It was horrible. It was horrible.
Let's on a more positive note in the town of Mashpee, one thing folks have been looking forward to is a dog park. Of course, dog owners. Dog parks are, boy, what a popular news story across Cape Cod. Anyway, so Mashpee Dog Park is coming, I understand.
It is. It's been a long time in the planning phase. There was a nonprofit group that started working on this back about 5 years ago. And then the town became involved about 6 months ago. And this week they received the conceptual design plan from CDM Smith, which has built a very successful dog park in Cambridge. And it looks as if that plan will be finalized next week. And then final construction plans will be done in September. And DPW Director Catherine Lauren here in Mashpee says that barring any extreme weather or any other unforeseen circumstances, the land clearing will begin in October, and we'll have a dog park in December with three areas, one main play area and one for puppies and one for older dogs. So,
and where in town will the park be located?
It's going to be off of Route 130 on Ashumet Road on the backside of Heritage Park.
Okay. Jeff Spillane is a reporter with the Mashpee Enterprise. He joins us every Friday here on the Roundup on WCAI. Jeff, we thank you.
Hey, you're welcome.
You can follow Jeff on Twitter at Jeff Spillane. That's G-E-O-F-F Spillane. And on the phone now, Jim DeRuda, editorial page editor at the New Bedford Standard Times. Hello, Jim.
Good morning, Sean.
Jim, you give me so many good stories each week that you want to talk about. There's a lot happening in New Bedford. Let's talk about EEE, Eastern Equine Encephalitis, and West Nile virus. Of course, the county's been doing a lot of spraying to try to cut down on the amount of infection there, but I understand not everyone's happy with that spraying.
No, not everyone's happy. It turns out that we have a growing population of organic and chemical-free farms in this area. So even the spraying of these organic mimic pesticides caused them consternation.
So they're trying to stop the spraying, or are they just raising a flag? Let's pay attention to this.
They won't really have the ability to stop any spraying because this is county-based spraying, which is done from the back of a pickup truck. It's done very early in the morning between 2 a.m. and sunrise because the pesticides are fatal for honeybees. So if the sun's not up, the bees aren't out, and it dissipates after 30 minutes, and the residue is completely biodegraded in 24 hours. But nevertheless, they're concerned, and they say they'd even rather fight the bugs than fight the chemicals. If it were a state spraying by overhead plane, as happened a couple years ago, they could call the state and say, please do not fly over my farm.
Oh, I see. Okay, and let's talk about the New Bedford school system briefly. We only got a minute left here. 31 veteran teachers left last year, so the whole bunch of new teachers going into the system, and they're hoping, it's really going to revitalize the school system there?
Yes, and it's not that 31 left last year. 31 left in July and August, last-minute departures, which the school systems know they're going to have to deal with each year. But it's interesting to see that those 31 mostly have gone to suburban schools and wanted to get out of this urban district. But more than 100 new teachers have come in. This is superintendent's second year, and this is when it really starts to pick up the pace on the turnaround in New Bedford, where it's a level four underperforming district.
And the kids are back at school already, or do they start on Tuesday?
They'll start next week.
Okay. They're doing great reporting over at the New Bedford Standard Times. I encourage people to pick up the paper or go to the website. And, of course, Jim DeRuda is the editorial page editor there. Jim, thank you very much.
Thank you, Sean.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, Nelson Siegelman of the Martha's Vineyard Times will join us. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on WCAI. We're discussing the top news stories of the week. I'm Sean Corcoran. With me in the Woods Hole studio is Sean Driscoll. He's a reporter at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. On the phone, Nelson Siegelman, the editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Hello, Nelson.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Officials destroyed a potentially hazardous military flare on East Beach on Chappaquiddick on Sunday. What was the situation there?
Well, this is what it's called as it's a marine location marker. It's a silver container about 2 feet long. They found this in the intertidal zone on Chappaquiddick, and it had a warning label on it telling anyone who might find it to be careful because it has flammable material. These things contain phosphorus. They're used in by the Navy and also the Coast Guard when they're doing drills. Apparently, they drop it over, it ignites, and that way they can locate someone during the day or at night. Well, they're designed to sink after they burn, but in this case, this flare did not sink, so they thought it might still contain some dangerous material. And the state police bomb squad and some people from the presidential detail from the Department of Defense, they're explosive experts, obviously I didn't have much to do, so they're really happy to go out to Chappaquiddick and blow this thing to smithereens and then clean up after it. But I guess the real key point here is that if people do come across these objects, they need to be careful and alert the proper authorities so that it can be disposed of and not go messing around with it.
Speaking of the president, I saw photos of him going to the Oak Bluffs fireworks on Friday, and reporting in your paper this week says that those fireworks almost didn't happen.
Yeah, this is one of those behind-the-scenes stories that you just happen to hear about. We were listening to the police scanner in the office, and about 5:30, as you know, cars were streaming to Oak Bluffs for the fireworks, I heard the fire chief on the radio saying to someone else, they say if the barge isn't moved, they're going to cancel the show. Well, you can imagine what Oak Bluffs would have been like, you know, all these people that were there for the fireworks and no show. But the problem was that we had a very strong east wind, and that was blowing the barge towards the shore. The barge snapped a couple of anchor lines, and it also meant that fireworks could easily drift over where people were gathered to watch the fireworks. But Ralph Packer, who is very well known on Martha's Vineyard, he has a barge operation among other operations. He really saved the day by getting his tugs there. I'm sorry, so he has a series of tugs as well. And he provided tugs that helped get the barge a little bit further offshore and kept the tugs there so that the barge was properly positioned. And the show, as they say, went on. And everybody was safe, and they enjoyed the evening, including President Obama and his family.
It was a very interesting story in this week's paper. I encourage people to go and read that about the behind-the-scenes Oak Bluffs fireworks. Nelson Siegelman is the editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thank you, Nelson.
Thank you.
And here in our Woods Hole studio is Sean Driscoll, a reporter at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. There was a real tragedy last week. Two young girls in a pool in Yarmouth, and they nearly drowned. And then we did hear that one of those girls has passed away, Sean.
Yes, it was a very sad story. Two girls, they were 9 and 12, had been pulled from the indoor pool at the Bayside Resort on Route 28 a week ago Wednesday now. And both girls were taken to Children's Hospital in Boston, and then earlier this week, the Yarmouth police found out last weekend that the 9-year-old was being taken off life support, and then she did later die, unfortunately, as a result of that near drowning.
And I know the Times looked into what the regulations are. The motel was not required to have a lifeguard on duty. State law does not require lifeguards on duty at these hotels and motels, but they do require that someone be on staff at the time the pool is open that is certified in CPR and first aid.
Right, and that was not the case at the point of this drowning, apparently. The town Department of Health had done an inspection, as it turned out, an unannounced inspection just that morning, and at the time there were staff members who were there who had that training, and in the evening, though, however, that was not the case, and there were some passerby or some other residents or guests there, rather, who did do some CPR that wasn't, I don't think, you know, exactly by protocol, but they were trying to help, but there was no one who actually was certified at the time. So the Department of Health is bringing the hotel staff, the hotel management, to a show cause hearing a week from Monday, I think, on the 8th, to discuss that situation. And also the manager says that he's going to expand the training to get more of his staff trained in CPR going forward.
Okay. Let's move to politics. And one candidate for state representative was out politicking and encountered the other candidate, or approached the other candidate, and sparks flew, I guess.
Yes. This was a real talker earlier this week. Freshman state representative Brian Mannell and his wife Sarah were out doing door-to-door campaigning, and they decided to stop by the home of his opponent in the race, Adam Chapralis. They both live in Centerville. And sparks flew at that conversation. And exactly what sparks flew in what direction is still a matter of debate. But later on, Mr. Chapralis went into the Barnstable Police Department to report threats and harassment that were directed at him by Brian Mannell. So whatever occurred in that, Mr. Chapralis obviously felt it was worth documenting with the Barnstable police.
And Representative Mantle is denying that.
Absolutely. He's saying that he wanted to go by Mr. Chappalis' house to talk to him about a debate and to get his phone number, because he's saying that some of his supporters were alleging that Chappalis was putting signs in their yard that they didn't want. So he wanted to go by to talk to him about it. And Chappalis said that the Mantles Brian was with his wife, Sarah, that they were verbally abusive and had a heated confrontation there at the door. They both say that the discussion / confrontation lasted about 5 minutes, but within that 5 minutes, there still seems to be some debate, and they both had, you know, discussions in local media and news conferences about it, and their stories are not lining up. But it was whatever happened there had some reverberations past the 5 minutes that they were at Chappalis' door having whatever conversation they did have.
Okay, and we expect both candidates to be on the point for a debate. I'm not sure if a exact date has been scheduled for that, but we'll certainly let you know about that. Let's talk about the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station and the storage of spent fuel rods there. Of course, the spent fuel rods, that's nuclear fuel that once it's done, they take it out and they put it right now at Pilgrim. They put it in a pool so it can cool down. And then eventually the plan was to put all this spent fuel in the U.S. in Yucca Mountain, and that is not going to be happening. So people don't know, the owners of these plants don't know where to put it. The NRC isn't sure exactly where to tell them to put it, but some residents in Plymouth are upset about the storage of the spent fuel.
That's right. 11 residents who live near the Pilgrim Power Plant are suing, arguing that the storage of these spent nuclear fuel are hurting property values in the area. Reasonable assumption, perhaps. Wow,
maybe a reactor might be hurting me.
Yes, a reactor also a little bit more noticeable. But these residents all live within 2 miles of the power plant, and they're challenging Energy and Plymouth officials who approved a permit letting the company build concrete pads to store the nuclear waste in concrete casks there. So the NRC and local officials approved Energy doing this. And now the residents are suing, saying, you know, hold the phone here. That's going to affect our property values negatively, and they're going to court to try to stop it.
Well, the owner of that plant's in a tough spot in terms of that spent fuel. If they don't take it out of that pool, the pool is full. They wouldn't be able to continue to operate the reactor. So they're looking at those dry casks, which I'm told on the positive side, those dry casks, the similar dry casks with spent fuel in it at Fukushima, held up pretty well during the disaster there. And it looks like that is where the industry is going.
It does. I mean, it all needs to go somewhere. So where is the question? And, you know, people, it's this debate is obviously going to go on and go on in the courts, at least in Pilgrim's case.
Sure.
Right,
opponents
now
of nuclear power are saying, look, do we really want to have spent fuel stored at these locations all around the country indefinitely? Let's talk about Cape Wind Renewable Energy here, the effort to install.
To another energy. Yeah. Right, actually.
And, of course, Cape Wind is the effort to install 130 wind turbines in Nantucket Sound that's been going on since, debate has been going on since 2001, and we had a long regulatory process. Now we're in the long judicial process as opponents have filed different complaints about that proposed wind farm. And so what's happening now in the legal arena?
Well, the opponents of it have filed their opening paperwork, their brief to appeal a federal judge's earlier decision to toss out their lawsuit that said that state regulators, when they approved the contract, that they violated the U.S. Constitution when they did that. The suit against Cape Wind, state officials, and NSTAR is being filed by the town of Barnstable, the Alliance to Protect Nantucket Sound, and several individuals and businesses. Now, back in May, a U.S. district judge found that I lost my train of thought, but basically there was in the spring, the U.S. district judge said that they
didn't
throw out the lawsuit. Yeah, didn't violate it at all.
No, they threw out the complaint.
Right, and being the being the legal process now, they're appealing that, and they're trying to get someone to reverse it. So it's just, you know, the next chapter in the long history of fights against Cape Wind and this project.
And meanwhile, the project does seem to be moving forward and have some momentum, both in the courts where it's every challenge has been batted down, and they've acquired a site in Rhode Island, and some discussion about what's going to happen with the site in New Bedford in mm-hmm. terms of where they will have staging areas to take the turbines and the foundations out into Nantucket Sound, assuming that it does happen. Anything could happen between now. I mean, I've been quoting spokespeople from Cape Wind for years saying construction begins next year.
Right. I think next year has never come.
No, I've been writing that phrase since 2006, so we'll see what happens next year. Let's go back again to the town of Sandwich, this time Heritage Museums and Gardens there, which is really a remarkable place in terms of all the plantings and the trees, and then they have an area for children there. They have a big museum there with classic cars, but they have a new initiative that they want to install at the Heritage Museums and Gardens, and some residents in the area are saying, hold on a second.
Right, exactly. The new part of the park that they want to open is an aerial adventure park that's complete with zip lines. Now, when I hear zip lines, I think about, you know, people screaming and going flying across an amusement park. But Heritage Garden says it's not going to be that rambunctious, that it's going to be a way for people to see their flora and fauna and the trees, a little bit closer up. It's not going to be high octane, not, you know, people shouting and hooting and hollering, but neighbors are still concerned about it. They're concerned about noise and the increased traffic. I mean, obviously, already there's a lot of traffic there at Heritage, and this is just going to increase it if it does go in. So there was a debate about it when they were discussing some road improvements they want to make, and it turned into sort of a referendum on this new feature that they're trying to install.
So the road improvements were related to eventually opening up this adventure park?
Or... Yes, I believe so. George Brennan wrote about this earlier this week, but it's all sort of part of some expansion and some improvements they're doing out there.
And you're right. You do have to drive through a very residential area or street in order to get to Heritage. And Heritage is a pretty quiet place right now.
And Heritage officials say they're not looking to change that. I mean, they're not putting in roller coasters. You know, this is not we're not turning this into they don't want to turn it into a Six Flags. But there's always concern that, you know, when you do expansion of something that's in a neighborhood, you're going to have more traffic, and, you know, the charter school is there. There's already a lot of things going on. So
I think they have a preschool.
The preschool. That's what I'm referring to. Excuse me. But, it's 20 cars here, 20 cars there. All of a sudden, residents are worried about that really adding up to even more traffic in their neighborhood.
Of course. Okay, and finally, I'd like to talk about this story about some concerns about some telemarketing that has been going on related to law enforcement. And law enforcement itself is saying, wait, hold on, when you get a phone call from someone saying they're representing the police or public safety.
Sure. Well, police and fire department officials often do use third-party telemarketers to help them do fundraising, mostly on the union side or for some special campaigns, but local departments are urging people to be cautious about giving donations to these solicitors. Not that they're necessary. I mean, in some cases, they may be not really representing the department, but also that these companies take a lot off the top. Their fees can be high, and there's, not a lot of times not everything. You know, if you give a dollar, 20 cents of that may only get to the charity of your choice. So departments have used these in the past, and now they're starting to pull back from it and reconsider how they're going to do fundraising, telemarketing fundraising, if at all, just because of the sort of the uncertain relationship with these third-party companies.
Okay. Well, I want to thank all my guests who participated today, and there were quite a few, beginning with Sean Driscoll, a reporter at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Of course, the Times is always with us here on the Roundup every Friday at 9, and again, the repeat at 7 o'clock. And Sean, thanks for coming into the Woods Hole studio today.
Thank you, Sean.
You can follow Sean on Twitter at Sean F. Driscoll. Of course, Sean is spelled S-E-A-N.
The right way. Thank you.
Well, you said that. But and thanks to our other contributors, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Sally Rose of the Provincetown Banner, Jeff Spillane of the Mashpee Enterprise, Jim Deruta of the New Bedford Standard Times, and Nelson Siegelman of the Martha's Vineyard Times. That's quite a list of area journalists. If you know an area journalist who's doing good stuff, encourage him to contact me. We'll get him on the Roundup. I want to thank you for listening. I'm Sean Corcoran.
The Friday News Roundup on The Point is produced by Sean Corcoran. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.